This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I remember I threw the script down the first time I read it because I thought he was going to do something so horrible, and then he doesn't. And so, it was just a real visceral experience. And then as soon as I really started to engage in his mind and who this person is, William Tell, what is his behavior like, the whole thing broke open for me. And that's what Paul does as a writer. He just gives an actor this playground of things to work with.
Hello, and welcome to The Awardist from Entertainment Weekly, taking you inside this year's top contenders for the Oscars and more of the industry's biggest awards. I'm Clarissa Cruz, EW's executive editor. I'm joined by my co-host, Josh Rothkopf, EW's senior movies editor. Hi, Josh.
Hello, greetings, happy awards seasoning. I am very excited about this week's episode. Today we have segments from two separate interviews, both of them with actors that we're pretty crazy about. Although their performances are a little under the radar, we have an interview with Jodie Comer, who was just so amazing in The Last Duel. And we also have an interview with Oscar Isaac, who was very memorable in Dune and also in Paul Schrader's The Card Counter. They've both given really great performances in these movies. And we want to cast light today, shed some light on the performers that, you know, really should be in the awards conversation more. But they're dark horses. They're not even on the bubble, per se. They're the performances that made movie going especially rich for us this year, and perhaps should be more forward in the awards talk, and maybe we can do some good here and steer attention in their direction. So why don't we start, actually, before we get to our interviews, tell me about Jodie Comer and that performance in Last Duel and why that so connected with you.
Yeah, I just thought Jodie was so great in that movie. I mean, I don't know how in case listeners haven't seen it, it's a movie told in three parts, and it's told from one man's perspective, another man's perspective, and then Jodie's perspective. And, you know, the movie sort of reenacts some of the same scenes just from these different perspectives. And Jodie is just mesmerizing throughout the whole thing. So basically, this movie tells the story about a man who's accused of rape of another man's wife. And it's told in three perspectives, as I said. And Jodie is the woman in question. And her performance, I think, is just key to this whole movie. Without her, I don't think it would have worked. And her sort of very subtle changes through the three parts of the movie, I think, were so amazing and just resonant and just grounded this movie in a way that I think, you know, maybe somebody else in that role wouldn't have been able to do. So I think it was super important. The journey of this movie is interesting because it was one of those movies that died a quick death at the box office, but then got a second life on streaming. You know, I think a lot of people just sort of dismissed it after that. And then when it actually, more people got to see it, they're like, oh, well, this is actually pretty good. So I think it was just a victim of its own sort of maybe bad marketing or bad box office. But I think for whatever reason, she deserved to have more recognition for this role and her part.
See, I'm not surprised to hear that at all, because I've long had this idea, this theory that Ridley Scott, the director, is actually a secret, maybe not so secret, feminist, and that his movies consistently, all the way back to Alien, have really, really strong women characters in them. I mean, obviously, something like Thelma and Louise would figure in that as well, but even movies like Someone to Watch Over Me, even G.I. Jane with Demi Moore, there's a through line throughout his entire filmography of these tough, you know, very sensible, strong women. And I love that aspect about his filmmaking, and this definitely seems to follow suit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you don't look at the trailer for this movie and think that there's going to be any humor in it, but a lot of the different perspectives that you find humor in, just sort of the ridiculousness of men and how they perceive a certain event. And then Jodie comes in and says, no, that's not actually how it happened. This is not how this was perceived. And I think it was just a very powerful way of structuring the movie and telling the story in an entertaining way, and being able to sort of communicate that through three versions of the same story, I think was really great.
When it's Ben Affleck in that haircut, I definitely would say it's a story about the ridiculous of men.
For sure.
There's a self-deprecating aspect of that film. And it's interesting. And maybe that's a good segue to the other interview we're going to feature, Oscar Isaac. I could talk for this entire podcast, for several podcasts, let's say, about Dune and how I think he's so great as Duke Atreides, Paul Atreides' father, Timothy Chalamet's father in this film. I think what he might get more attention for, actually, in terms of critics and not Oscars, though, so manage expectations, is The Card Counter, which is his leading role in Paul Schrader's new film. And The Card Counter is like so painfully Paul Schrader. It's a painfully Paul Schrader-ish movie. It's about a solitary man who's journaling. He's keeping a diary. He's just like Robert De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, in Taxi Driver, another Paul Schrader script. He's talking about how he's the lonely man, and he's a gambler, and that's a big metaphor. And then, of course, he meets a woman played by Tiffany Haddish, and there's a very subtle, refreshingly adult, middle-aged flirtation that happens between them. And then there's also, a lot of subtext about guilt and recrimination. He's a former soldier who actually was stationed at Abu Ghraib. So there's a sub-layer about malfeasance and political war crimes. And so there's a lot going on in this movie, and it's dense.
A light romp.
Yeah, it's the kind of movie that I think critics kind of flipped out over, but then it disappeared in about 20 minutes. Like, it wasn't on a radar in terms of box office, but it definitely satisfied fans of Schrader's economy and the way he makes movies that taste almost distilled, like distilled vodka or something. There's something that's very concentrated about his style of filmmaking. It's not a lot of fuss. There's no fancy camera moves. And Oscar Isaac really understood that, and how he was going to have to hold the camera and hold the entire story just with a 1,000-yard stare and his eyes, and the idea of being a persuasive gambler, someone who just wants to go from hand to hand and not really think about the past or the future for that matter. He's just thinking about the pot growing. And that's a very suggestive character to play. Gamblers have a great history in cinema. But The Card Counter, that's a performance that I flipped over. I thought he was terrific. And I actually do think that Schrader's films succeed or fail based on the casting, so if it's Willem Dafoe or if it's Nick Nolte in Affliction, then I feel like there's a lot of interest there. And sometimes his casting isn't as strong, but this would definitely be in the strong category for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel like this was just one of those movies that's just like the slowest of the slow burn. I have less of an attention span, so it was hard for me to stay in it the whole time. But there's no denying that Oscar Isaac is a very magnetic actor. I mean, he's in the internet's boyfriend for a reason, and I think he played to his strengths in this role, and it was really different from the kinds of things that he's been doing. It was definitely certainly different from what he did in Dune, but that same soulfulness and that same, kind of seriousness, I think, played itself well here.
Absolutely. And when I think about the performance that he gives in Dune, there's a line that Oscar Isaac has that I think it's probably the strongest moment in all of Dune, even though his role is limited, and I don't want to spoil it, but the whole film, at least this first half, is about Timothy Chalamet's Paul coming into this destiny, the possibility that he may be fated to lead a revolution, and it's a political awakening. But there's a moment very early in the film where he's talking with his father, and they're leaving their home planet of Caladan to go to Dune, an inhospitable desert planet. And he looks at his dad, and his dad says, I'm paraphrasing, but this is Oscar Isaac killing it. And he says, even if you only realize that you were supposed to be my son, that would be enough for me, and I would love you for it. And this whole idea that the destiny and the weight of fate, the weight of this whole messianic plot that Frank Herbert devises for this novel, is just on the one hand, and on the other hand is a father's love for a son. And maybe that's really all we need to be as people, is just to be good sons and daughters and fathers and mothers. And I feel like that's why Dune is beloved. That's one of the reasons why Dune is beloved, is because it's both intimate and universal and sprawling. And it's the kind of thing where if you're losing the thread in terms of all the different aliens and dialects and all the, you know, the density of Dune that its fans really love, there's throughout this really moving, understandable, approachable through line, basically, about family and royalty to some degree as well. So Oscar Isaac, I think, really delivers a lot of the emotion to that film, and a film that I think needs it. Hopefully, in part two, he'll have his share of flashbacks.
Yeah, hope so. Yeah, no, he's great. I mean, it's been a great year for him. He also had Scenes from Marriage with fellow Oscar contender Jessica Chastain.
Is that his best clip of the year, that runway clip that went viral?
Oh, I think so. I think that's the clip of 2021, yeah. Right. I don't want to discount the rest of his stuff, but that one was pretty good. Who else are you thinking about, Josh? I don't want to call them long shots, but just those that we want to advocate for. I mean, you know, we're Oscar voting season is upon us. And, you know, if there are people that you want to advocate for or pull for, who would that be?
Well, yeah, there are people I want to advocate for. And I think it would start with Joanna Hogg's The Souvenir Part 2. And obviously anything that's like a part 2 or sequel there's going to be an initial resistance, especially if you haven't seen part one. But I'm crazy about The Souvenir. The Souvenir is written and directed by Joanna Hogg, and it's an autobiographical movie about her time in film school in the early and mid 80s, actually. And then The Souvenir Part Two continues her journey. The character's name is Julie, and she's played by Honor Swinton Byrne, Tilda Swinton's daughter. It's an amazing performance. And the reason why The Souvenir Part 2 might even be better than The Souvenir Part 1, it's the rare case of a sequel perhaps being better than its first part, is that the first film is really about how bad romance can affect you. Like, are you going to survive a bad boyfriend, a heroin-addicted boyfriend? And that's, you know, that's a harrowing story whenever it's told, but it's something that is familiar. Part two, on the other hand, is about after you've survived it, how do you then turn those lessons into art, into filmmaking? So it's both about making art, and it's about finding vitality and strength and actually using it to propel yourself forward. So there's something that's very inspiring about The Souvenir Part Two. Honor Swinton Byrne continues to just kill it. It's funny, has Richard Ayoade in it. And I think that Joanna Hogg, she always conceived this as a two-part movie, and she's really ended up making something very rich, something that if you watch two parts back to back feels like of a piece. And this is not a movie that's ever going to be nominated in any circumstance, and I wish that were different. I wish that weren't the case. I wish that we were talking about Honor Swinton Byrne, or at least Joanna Hogg's script in some context. Did you like The Souvenir?
I didn't see The Souvenir because I had the same reaction of like, oh, you know, in the triage of trying to see as many movies as we can in order to do the awards coverage. You know, that one just seemed like less of a priority to me because of the two, but that's why we have you, Josh, so that you can fill in the gaps in my knowledge.
You can't see everything. You can't hog everything.
I can't Joanna hog everything. I mean, I trust you and Leah Greenblatt, our film critic also. So, you know, it definitely seems like something that not just you two, but I, you know, in the atmosphere, in the awards atmosphere, you know, I've heard this. And so it is in my never ending queue.
There is something that happens with critics too. They didn't give it many awards either, as much as I thought they were going to. There's something about the shiny object that comes along. So right. If you had asked people around the time of Cannes, maybe we'd have all said, oh, The Souvenir Part Two, but by the time Drive My Car is picked up or whatever it is now, you know, the attentions have shifted.
It's good that you mentioned Drive My Car because when we're talking about advocacy, I do think that there is heat behind that movie. But one movie, and it's fresh in my mind because it's the last one I saw, was The Worst Person in the World. Absolutely. There are a couple performances there that we both want to advocate for. But that was just, that blew my mind. You and Leah were telling me for months that movie was going to blow my mind. and it did. It did. It's a Norwegian movie and a very different take on a rom-com. Although, I don't want to call it a rom-com. I don't want people to go into it thinking it's like that. I guess it's kind of a romantic dramedy.
It's flirty and it has funny moments.
Yeah. And I thought it was just so well done. Yeah.
Has this gut punch. I mean, it really,
yes,
it is a movie about a lot of deep ideas, and those performances, not just Renata Reinsby, who is just carrying this film on her mighty shoulders, but I think Anders Danielsson Lee, who plays the first boyfriend, is also this incredible performance in the film. I think what's great about Worst Person in the World is that its characters aren't just one thing. You know, you watch a rom-com, you're right, it's too reductive a term, but if you were to watch a rom-com, there are types that the supporting cast always sort of have to fit into the parameters of. So you have this sort of the bitchy ex-girlfriend, or the sort of the bad boyfriend from the past, and then there's the too perfect, you know, alternative, or the, like, there's cliches and stereotypes that this film, The Worst Person in the World, just deftly avoids. And every single person who's trotted on is messy and understandably human and rich. There's a lot of facets to these characters, and you realize watching it, like, we don't have to settle for less. We could have so much more from our movies, especially ones that deal with things that we're all relating to, love and loss and the idea of connecting with another person, and how much do you get out of a relationship? How much do you give to relationships? That film nourished me. I loved it. And I think those performances should be in the conversation, but for some reason, they're not in the conversation. So why is that?
I don't know. I mean, like, I think performances in movies take on a momentum of their own maybe because we're on the inside of this sort of award season, you know, bubble, sometimes it becomes an echo chamber of people saying, okay, yeah, this person is the front runner, and this person is, you know, is the person's going to upset. And there's only so many slots and so many things to talk about. I'm not saying it's all about groupthink, but I think that, you know, that's why it's a campaign, because it's a skill to keep people in the conversation throughout this entire time. And this award season seems particularly drawn out.
It does. I mean, it's hard. It's especially if you're talking about, let's say, a Sundance movie that has to sustain a campaign sometimes 13, 14, 15 months. I mean, it's not just making sure that a movie stays in the front of people's minds, but it's also, there's a spend involved. These are expensive, these campaigns. So if you're talking about a little movie like Flea or Summer of Soul or Passing, one of those Sundance movies that really knocked us out, those campaigns really have got, it's a stamina game for them. And I also think that there's an organizing principle that I think we all have as human beings, where we want to sort of rank things and we want to kind of, I think this is just the nature of just awards in general. Having a front runner helps because it allows us to cohere our thoughts and gather attention around one person, and also, you know, maybe argue and fight for people who are on the rise. And so, I don't know, maybe there's something easier about having a sort of a bracket of nominees. I wish that we had room for more nominees in all the different categories. And I love the fact that the Best Picture race is no longer five films. I almost kind of wish we could do that with the acting performances. I mean, would that just be too crazy? That would be too crazy.
I don't know. Crazy for who? You know, like who's really, you know, like if it's about including more people, and then maybe, you know, something like Spider-Man, which got a lot of attention once it, you know, made all that money. Maybe it would be good for the Oscars to be a little bit more mass, because I think the average viewer oftentimes will see, like, okay, I haven't seen any of these movies. I'm not really that interested in the show. There shouldn't be so much of a divide between what is covered at the Oscars and what people's actual movie interests are.
There shouldn't be a divide like that. And I want to believe that the Oscars is making a turn towards greater accessibility. Obviously, this year, they're going to have a host for the first time in a while. And it may very well be that the performances that are nominated and that eventually make it to the podium represent a wider swath of the talent. This is always the reason why, whenever that argument comes up about should we have categories that don't have gender, so maybe it should just be best actor for both men and women in one category. I never like that as an idea because ultimately it just means fewer awards are given out and fewer people are recognized. When the fact of the matter is, if you love movies like we all do here in The Awardist, you want to celebrate as many of them as possible. Is there another performance? Is there another film or a script or a director, or someone, anyone that is just not being talked about that you think should be?
You know, I mentioned this, I think, in the beginning of our podcast, but I really liked Red Rocket and Simon Rex. He was fantastic in that. He was mesmerizing. He was fascinating. And I think such an interesting, flawed, crazy, narcissistic character that you still end up rooting for. And I just think that's such a stacked category that he's sort of gone quiet in the conversation. But I still think that he was fantastic, that would want to advocate for that. What about you?
I think that there is a world, we just don't live in it, but there's a world out there in which Zola is a huge, huge critical darling and massive audience and critical and Oscar success. But we don't somehow live in this world. Zola, it's such a strange anomaly. The film already feels so old. And I think it first played at Sundance 2 years ago, right? You know, but it's, I feel like that's a movie that was so current and it felt so now. It's based on a string of tweets, and Riley Keough and Taylor Page are both so extraordinary in that movie. And what they're doing, I think, is extremely difficult, which is cementing a kind of a friendship and at the same time exploiting each other and subtly jockeying for power. It feels hip to social media and to the ways we communicate, but without it seeming like a like scolding, like, ooh, social media, bad for you. There's something that felt very fresh about it. And I just wish that that film were somehow having its own Oscar moment. That, again, this is not a universe that we live in, you know? So, but check that one out if you haven't already.
On that note, let's go into our two performances that we would like to advocate for. The first is Jodie Comer for her fantastic performance in The Last Duel, followed by Oscar Isaac for his performance in Card Counter, but Dune as well. So enjoy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm here with Jodie Comer, star of The Last Duel. Thanks for stopping by, Jodie.
Of course. How are you?
I'm good. We're here to talk about The Last Duel, where, Jodie, you gave such an amazing performance. I've been a fan of yours since Killing Eve, but this just blew me away. Can you tell our listeners what The Last Duel is about for those who haven't seen it?
Yes, of course. It's about one woman's fight for justice, ultimately. The story is set in medieval France, and Marguerite is a woman who testifies that she is raped by the friend of her husband. And the story follows on from there. It's an interesting kind of format. The story is told from three perspectives, which I thought was quite a dangerous way to tell a story in a way. You know, it was very important for everyone involved, actually, that people come away from this movie knowing that she was the one who was telling the truth, you know. And I was really fascinated by this kind of play with perspective, and because I think it's very true of how we live our lives, you know. We can come away from a situation and have a very different retelling, but there is ultimately one truth. And I thought she was remarkable and extremely courageous. So to have been given the opportunity to give her a voice was what I was most drawn to.
Exactly what you said. I thought the movie's treatment of perception and perspective was so fascinating. And I loved seeing how the same scenarios were interpreted in different ways, particularly how it shows how blind and ridiculous the male ego can be sometimes. Did you modify your performance for the different parts, and how so?
Yeah, I mean, for each, especially for Legris and Carouge's narrative, you know, I had to really kind of think about how it was they saw me, you know, as a wife and as an acquaintance. and really try and think about what they needed from me in those moments to tell their side of the story, you know, which is an interesting way to work as an actor, because usually you only hone in and focus on your own instinct and your own motives. And I was often having to go against that a lot of the time, which was fun sometimes, you know, it's great to be able to play around with that. I felt a lot more relaxed about doing that once we'd established Marguerite's version on camera. Like, I felt very protective of that. but it was a really fascinating way to work, you know, and I think the biggest thing that we had to think about was just the level of how much we pushed it. I think what's beautiful about the script and what Matt, Ben and Nicole did, and what's kind of fascinating is that in those scenes that are played from different perspectives, the dialogue is exactly the same. So it was very evident to me that a lot of this was going to be performance led. So there's a challenge in itself. Yeah, it was really, really fascinating. And then, you know, you never want the audience to be one step ahead of you. So I think that's when we really had to think about, okay, how far do we push this reaction? How far do we push this glance? But yeah, I think it's a really enjoyable part of the film, especially when you get to the end. I feel like when you get to the end, it makes you think back to all the moments you've seen previously and like kind of reassess and go, oh, okay. At least that is my is my hope.
Yeah, no, that was exactly the experience that I had watching it. And I think that's the sign of a really engaging movie, is that you keep on turning it over in your head and kind of reliving the scenes with the knowledge that you have at the end. And I thought that I think it was such a testament to your performance, because really, I don't think that would work without you at the center of this.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Can you tell me about some of the decisions you made as an actress for your performance? Because I just thought it was such a strong center to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some moments that I can think of were just, I really wanted to have a sense of personality, you know, and wit and humor, and just to make sure she was alive. I think there's a tendency sometimes and a danger that when we play people from a historical period, you know, there is definitely you know, different manners, and there was a certain expectation and elegance and poise. But then there is something, I think there can be a danger there where a performance can become quite stiff. And I really didn't want that for her, especially when she's so young and full of life and desires. And so like little choices, I guess I can think of is there's one tiny one that I kind of enjoyed when I saw it back, was there's a really simple kind of beat of the scenes played in two perspectives. It's in Carouge's and it's in Marguerite's, and they're at the dinner table with her mother-in-law, and he says, "I'm off to Paris." And in Carouge's version, you know, she kind of leans over the table longingly and she's like, "Please don't go." And then I think in her version, I might have threw an eye roll in, which may be pushing it a little bit too far. But really was like, I like that. And then he was always kind of encouraging, you know, me to bring kind of parts of myself out in those beats. So that was always enjoyable, you know. A lot of it is I'm not really aware of. Like, what I really enjoy about the process and what I do is like, I like to do my homework and know ways maybe how I want to play it. But then I very much like to leave it to the day and see what the actor opposite me has given me and what we're kind of finding in the moment. It's interesting because, you know, this very simple things I had in my head was, you know, Carouge thinks he is the best husband in the world. You know, he thinks I'm a doting wife, happy marriage, great sex life, no, a marriage made from love is what he thinks, you know. And then there's Legree's narrative, which is something totally different. So I feel like once I knew those kind of basics, I then had a kind of playground to kind of experiment in.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think the movie says some very telling things about, as I mentioned before, the male ego and perspective. And like you said, you know, the different characters interpreting the same event as something totally different. What went into your playing of those sort of idealized parts? I mean, idealized on their end,
yeah,
as opposed to yours. I mean, how did you bring sort of an honesty to that?
I just had to treat it as reality, you know, just had to treat it as, okay, this is the truth in this in this moment. But it was funny because, you know, when I got told about the project and I met Ridley, and, you know, they really wanted to champion her and her story and make sure that she came out of this storytelling as the hero. And I remember flicking, you know, reading the script and going through page by page and going, hang on a minute, where is she? What's going on? Like, and then, you know, the payoff was so huge for me at the end because I realized I'd kind of played into that assumption that she was the wife. She was almost like a prop within the telling of this story. And it was really interesting because I remember when the film got announced and, you know, there was kind of like a synopsis of what it was going to be. And that was very much what people thought Marguerite was going to be, you know. And yes, you know, her telling is at the end, but I feel like it's all the more powerful because you are left with her and you kind of realize, you know, that kind of length of time. I don't know. I feel like it really speaks to what it must have been like to be a woman in that time and watching, waiting, listening, and never really being able to speak your truth, you know, and she did that.
Mm-hmm. I found it super resonant. You know, obviously that this was many years ago that the story is set in, but there are so many things about, you know, finding your voice and finding your place in the world, you know, as a woman in a man's world that for better or worse are still things that people grapple with now. And I mean, is that something that attracted you to the script where even though it was set in this time, it sort of brings up the question of how far have we really come in a way?
It's really exposing, isn't it? I mean, I feel like it really holds a mirror up to us as a society when you realize, you know, when you think about the courtroom scene where she's sat alone in front of all of those men while they ask her the most personal, insulting questions about the experience, it's about the assault itself, about her sexual pleasures, you know, and you realize that, you know, like many women who speak out today, you know, they are doubted, they are questioned, they are publicly humiliated, you know, it's all of these things. And when you realize that this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and yes, we have come a long way, but we've by no means come far enough. And I think that wasn't lost on me, you know, I really felt a sense of a duty of care really when exploring this and showing this on the screen, because I knew there was going to be so many people who tune in to watch this film and connect with it in some way on a personal level. Yeah, I was always very aware of that. And I think I never wanted the scenes to be gratuitous. You know, I think what's so powerful and confronting about the rape in Marguerite's story is it's so intimate, you know, you're right in with her face. You don't see anything else. You just see her face. And that was I felt a really powerful decision that was made for that telling.
Yeah, I found that there were so many powerful moments in the movie.
For me, Nicole, you know, we couldn't have done it without Nicole because she brought such a nuance and a depth to Marguerite that I feel you need a woman's sensibility, you need an understanding, and she's a ton of fun. Yeah. which I always appreciate in a person.
yeah. They were talking about sort of late night writing sessions at Matt's house. Did you ever sit in on any of those, or were you not involved until later?
Yeah, no, they did. They invited me around. And I was, because at first I was kind of like, oh no, I don't need to do that. And I was like, no, come on. You know, it's just like that thing, like stepping outside of yourself and just realizing where you are. And I was kind of, you know, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm sat around a table with these three people kind of, and then wanting to know what I'm thinking. And, you know, especially there's a moment at the end before the duel when she's with her baby and Karouche comes in and she has this moment of like a realization of God, of I now see why so many women before me have not spoken out, is because I am now so confronted by what I have to lose. And I remember I sat with them around the table for that moment. We were trying to figure out, you know, what she would say, you know, and where I experienced that and was introduced to that was on Killing Eve. You know, before Killing Eve, I thought, you know, you're an actress, you lay in your lines, you go to set, you go home, and that's, you know, you don't need to do any more than that. And then having worked on Killing Eve and for a long time, and you know, as each season goes on, the producers kind of you know, kind of saying, come on, you're at this table. What is it you think? What is it you want? What do you feel? Is this working? Is it not? You get a real sense of your own voice and your instincts. So I think that's what Killing Eve introduced to me. So it's, I realize now that, oh God, the experience is so much more fruitful when you're present in those types of conversations and you listen to what other people have picked up on or, you know, that you may have missed and you think, oh God, that's a brilliant idea. I never ever thought of that. And it's such a collaboration. And The Last Duel really, really was, and that's hugely down to those guys.
Yeah. What was it like working with Matt and Ben? I mean, they're so iconic in so many ways and obviously have been friends for a long time. I mean, what did they do to sort of get you into the group?
I mean, they didn't have to do anything. They're just lovely. Like, they're very, very friendly and very down to earth. And, you know, that's what I think is interesting about, you know, kind of public image and persona and what's kind of created. And then, you know, like, having watched their work for many, many years and being a huge admirer and then seeing them in real life. And, you know, the work is the first and most important thing to them. And they're just normal people. You know, it's like, just like everyone else. They were great. And as was Adam, you know, I had a lot of kind of tricky material with Adam, but he was, you know, hugely respectful and we again got on very, very well. And it just felt like an incredibly safe space for everyone to just, you know, do the best work.
Yeah. Speaking of safe space, I wanted to ask you about the rape scene because it, and done, you know, three times in the movie. I mean, what was it like to shoot that? I did some reading about, you know, past interviews with Ridley and just sort of how he directed it. And can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we stepped down for 5 months due to COVID. So we actually shot these scenes near the last couple of weeks of the shoot in its entirety. The night before we were due to film those scenes, Ridley, Adam and I, we met at the studio and we went to the set and we blocked the scene out physically, not at kind of 100%, but literally just kind of stepping through positions, you know, lift, you know, just trying to figure out how we got to the bed. We always knew that was where we were to end up and the rest was just to be figured out and found in the moment. But Ridley was like, I kind of need to know roughly where you guys are going to land, because he sets the cameras up. He has 4 or 5 cameras. So we did that. We went home. We came to set the next morning. The set was ready to shoot. The cameras were in position. And Adam and I were kind of, we were just given the space to find it. And there's just something very electric about the whole experience, because the set that really creates almost feels like a theater. The takes were cut eventually, but you know, one take was like 8 minutes long. So it was quite a duration, you know, but it's funny because those kind of moments, like, sometimes often very rare, but when you're so present, it's almost like you're not aware of what's going on. You know, I feel like we both kind of just gave our all into that space and into each other and just was very clear about if either of us is uncomfortable, this is what we say, you know, we step away. We had an incredible intimacy coordinator called Ita O'Brien, who's done incredible work. And, you know, when we finished a take, every single crew member put down their tools, they stepped away, they left the room, and Ridley came in and we just kind of had a couple of minutes to compose ourselves and just speak very gently about what we thought we'd found, if it felt right, if it didn't feel enough, you know, all those things. And again, we shot Marguerite's version first, which I was extremely grateful of. And then we had to figure out how this act somehow could have seemed complicit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, difficult to watch. And so I was just wondering if it was difficult to shoot. But it sounds like it was done with the utmost of professionalism and sensitivity.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, lastly, the thing that really kept with me after watching the film is that there was no waffling over what the truth was. And I thought that was a very strong statement for the film to make. But in the end, you know, super satisfying, you know, as a watcher because
oh, good. I'm glad that you felt that.
Yeah. And I was wondering how you felt about that.
Yes.
There's really no question of what the truth was, even down to the wording of it on the screen when the words fade and it's just left with the truth. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's the only way we could have told this story. Like I said, this playing around with perspective is so fascinating. And it did feel kind of dangerous because I was like, this has to be executed in such a way that there is no doubt. And I think for me, what's such a beautiful moment is that final beat, you know, when you see her with her child and that kind of breath and acceptance that you sense from her that she went through this terrible thing, but her life will not be defined by it. And she lived many years and she never remarried, you know, and she loved her child. Like her child was the most important thing to her, irrespective of who the father may or may not be. You know, I feel like her child was the first time she probably ever truly felt love, actually. And I really love that moment at the end. I feel it really kind of summed that up perfectly for her.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really beautiful moment. And your performance is a really beautiful performance. So thank you so much for joining us on The Awardist today, Jodi.
Thank you, Clarissa. It was a pleasure.
Our thanks to Jodi Comer for sitting down with us. The Last Duel is now available streaming. Now we have Clarissa's interview with Oscar Isaac.
Welcome, Oscar. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Clarissa.
You play two very different characters here in Dune and Card Counter. Can you tell me what your prep was like for both films? We can start with Card Counter, where you play William Tell, a professional gambler with a mysterious past. What attracted you to that role?
Paul Schrader. I mean, pretty simple. I actually, out of school, right when I'd gotten out of school in 2005, 2006, I was out in LA and I auditioned for him in this little strip mall in the valley somewhere. He had gotten like this black box theater and I went in there and auditioned for him and I got the role, but unfortunately the movie never ended up coming together, but we stayed in touch. And then all these years later, he wrote me an email one morning and just said, I wrote this script and I think you'd be great for it. And you want to do it. And I read it and I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I'm like, what did I just read? I don't even understand it. So I read it a second time, then a third time, and slowly the character started to emerge for me because he is quite opaque. It's hard to understand. You know, I thought it was going one way with this strange thing that he does of wrapping all of the furniture and his surroundings in this white cloth. And it's so scary and off-putting. And I remember I threw the script down the first time I read it because I thought he was going to do something so horrible. And then he doesn't. It was just a real visceral experience. And then as soon as I really started to engage in his mind and who this person is, William Tell, what is his behavior like? It just the whole thing broke open for me. And that's what Paul does as a writer. He just gives an actor this playground of things to work with, whether it's his movement, his body, his posture, the way he speaks, the way he thinks, the cardistry, the penmanship. He writes history in the dialogue. He's very much like a Harold Pinter in that way. There's so much depth in between the lines. He writes the subconscious at work. And so for me, you know, it had been a while since I'd gotten to really delve into a character like that. And it just gave me so much energy to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been quite a change, considering the roles that you're most known for in sort of these kind of bigger franchises and blockbusters. What was it like to sort of work on this more, I guess, intimate scale?
It's such a different thing. You know, it's such a labor of love. It's a tiny little movie. We shot it 20 days in Biloxi, Mississippi, in these really old, pretty garish casinos. And that was also incredibly fun because in between takes, I would go and sit at the tables and play poker with the locals and, won a few rounds, which was really fun. But I felt like I really got to live in it. And also, it's just amazing because, you know, Paul Schrader, he's been around forever. He's an old dude. And yet there's such a subversive kind of punk rock energy to him, and the way he shoots and the way he knows what the story is. And that was astounding. It was quite different from talking to him about the script, you know, and, you know, all of those conversations. Suddenly there's just so much confidence and assuredness where he would know the difference between, like, okay, that's not the movie, that's the movie, you know, just the difference in that camera angle, you know, and to know that right away, it just felt, I just had so much trust. And so I could dare to let my thoughts dictate what I did, you know, without fear of, like, having to protect myself or having to make sure the audience knows I'm feeling this or I'm feeling that. I could just live in it and trust that this man who has such a handle on this story and the way that the tone of the movie has to play out, that he'll let me know when it's not enough or when it's too much. And I think day one, halfway through the day, he came up to me and he's like, I think you really got a hit on this character. I think you know this guy. And that just was an amazing feeling.
I mean, you also sort of have to trust that the audience is going to go along for this ride, because it is a slower paced film, and sort of keeping that balance between being true to the pace of the film, but also making sure that people stay in it. How did you sort of tread that?
Well, it's exactly right. Like, it isn't up to me, you know. I think what's up to me is to be honest and to play it honestly and to really have the thoughts, because you're with him, you know, you're following him, and he's also a man, but he's also an allegory for the American guilt and the American conscience and what's happened over these many years in these endless wars. And that's not anything that I can play, but that's a lot of the heavy lifting that the film is doing. And what it does is it frees me up. You know, it's not like the Star Wars films or even Dune, which, you know, is a beautifully poetic film, but you're in service to almost like a symphony, you know, you're in service to, like, this bigger thrust of a story. And that, you know, and that's about, like, nailing a very specific target. Whereas this was not that. This was living inside the thoughts and the behavior of this very specific individual, and allowing the context of what Paul does around it to dictate the emotional story, you know? So that's very freeing as an actor, you know, and that's why it kind of gives you so much energy back, because you just have to, like, live in the thoughts, and the thoughts that he writes are just so profound.
Absolutely. I read somewhere, or maybe I saw you talking about it, but that you almost enlisted in the Marines when you were younger. Was there something about William's background that appealed to you, given your previous interests?
Well, I actually did enlist in the Marines. I had taken the first oath, and I'd gone to this hotel where they do, like, these first tests that they do, like the medical examinations and these physicals. And then at the last moment, you know, stuff came around. My band got a gig, and, you know, my friend that I was going to go with, so he and I had a falling out, and then it just didn't happen. So yeah, I think there is always something, there's a little part of me that just wonders, you know, wow, what kind of life would that have been? You know, just the trajectory. At the time, I wanted to go in for combat photography. So I still had this kind of, like, artistic, you know, bent for it. And I remember they had given me a pamphlet of all, like, the famous artists that had been Marines, like Brian Dennehy and these different people. Yeah, so, like, they were speaking specifically to people that were interested in that. So yeah, there's certainly a part of me that's curious about that and can relate to that idea. You know, I think there's my mind can work in that kind of military way often. Yeah, like a particular kind of shutting off of elements of myself to, like, focus on the mission, you know. So yeah, there's something to that. And then the being someone that grew up in a very religious household, you know, the idea of guilt and the role that guilt plays. And so those two things kind of coming together, And this was the other really interesting thing, right? You show a character that's very closed off, but you're with him so much and you're hearing his voice and you're hearing his voiceover. So you can't help, just by the very nature of the construct, to get closer to this character, and you're with him and you've decided this is my protagonist. And you have a sense that he's done something wrong. Maybe he killed somebody. He did something bad. And then when it's revealed what he did, it's so bad, you know, it is really, it's about as bad as it can get, right? And then what happens? Like, how do we stay with this character after that point? And I think the fact that this is someone who lives in like a self-flagellating purgatory of his own making, I think there's just something that's so compelling about that.
Right. You sort of play a father figure to Ty Sheridan's character, and also in Dune, the actual father for Timothy. These are very different roles, but was there something about that specific part of them that appealed to you?
I wouldn't say that's the thing that particularly appealed to me first. You know, there were so many other elements of both of those things. But as I entered into those stories, you're absolutely right that those are kind of the pivotal elements of who those characters end up being. You know, it's their identity. You know, especially for William, he's living just this kind of non-existence, and it's this kid that suddenly gives him a new identity, or at least a new a window opens onto a possible life of redemption, or a life of at least a life. And I know Ty as well. Like, we worked together before, and such a sweet guy, you know. And I'm a relatively new dad. I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, boys as well. And so yeah, I didn't have to stretch too far to think about that kind of feeling of trying to impart the better qualities of your life onto somebody else in the hopes that they don't make the same mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Transitioning over to Dune, what was your journey with that? I mean, were you a fan of the book or the previous movies when you were younger?
Yeah, I was a big fan of the book. My dad also, I remember he had both the David Lynch film and the miniseries from like 2000 on tape at home. He really loves Dune. And so I wrote to Denis when I heard that he was directing it, and just said that I was a big fan. And he said, okay, good to know. And then, yeah, a couple years later, he wrote and sent me the script and said—
Like 2 years?
Yeah, it was about 2 years. Yeah, it took a while. And he sent me the script. And he didn't tell me what character. He just said, take a look and see what, you know, speaks to you. And for me, it felt pretty obvious that the Duke, you know, for me, it's the Duke. Even the way he's described in the book, it's just something that I related to. You know, just his, it's a tragic character. And for some reason, I'm drawn to tragic characters. And, you know, the fact that he's just from the get-go, he's just up against it. And still trying to do the right thing, trying to impart his values to his son, trying to survive, you know, doing anything he can to get some leverage in this impossible situation. I just found that really kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. As you were sort of prepping for this, like as an actor, I can imagine, you know, you knew that this was going to be a massive production, you know, these huge sets, these massive effects, this really big cast. How do you sort of unlock your character in the midst of all this bigness and keep it real?
Yeah, well, it's just locating the source of real emotion in the character, his engine, and then, you know, relentlessly digging and going back to the book. And I'd come back to Denis with like, hey, you know, there's this really cool thing in the book. You know, is there some place that we can add this in? And, you know, continually trying to deepen it and make it more interesting and make it more resonant. Even, you know, his last words, he didn't have any words written. He had no dialogue written. And I really felt like he's got to say something at the end. And so I kind of looked through the book and I found this thing that he says in the book. He says it to his troops, but he says, here I am, here I remain. And I just thought that was a really powerful thing to say. And so I was glad that that ended up being his final words before he bites down on that tooth.
Right.
So, but that's just a one example of, you know, looking, you know, that scene with Lady Jessica, right before they go to sleep. That was one that we worked on and kind of invented that was not in the script originally. So there was a lot of room to try to get to the heart of that, because it was clear to all of us that the real emotional core of the whole film is the family, is mom, dad, and Paul. And if you don't care about them, or if you don't really believe that trifecta, it's not going to really have a lot of impact what happens later.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm glad you brought up the tooth biting scene. I mean, you have some really strong scenes in the movie, but the most memorable for me was that one. Your scene with the Baron. I mean, you can't move, you're naked. You have to sort of communicate everything with your eyes. What was it like shooting that scene, and what kind of direction did you get from Denis?
It was pretty nightmarish. That whole scenario and that set was just astounding. And the lighting, I mean, Everything about it was just so scary. I'm trying to remember when he first said, like, well, I think it must have been in the script. I think it was just like he's been stripped of his clothing, you know. And there was some thought, you know, I think originally, like, you know, he doesn't have to be naked. I was like, no, he should be naked, man. This is like it's like Christ on the cross kind of moment, you know?
Yeah.
And so we kind of came up with a few different ideas of what his posture would be. And then that's where we came up with that great idea of seeing the bull's head, this motif that's been, you know, never talked about really or explained. It's just kind of been traveling along with him as this omen. And then just getting finally to have a chance to play with Stellan Skarsgård as the bear, and that was just incredible.
It's terrifying. He's so terrifying.
Terrifying, and just the floating in this weird gown. That was really terrifying. But I loved it. We had a lot of fun. We laughed so much.
So I would not expect that.
At one point when Denis wasn't looking, I may have left my cock sock in his pocket. Just so he just had a little bit of me next to him when I left.
like a little handkerchief.
Handkerchief. Just a little musty handkerchief.
Yeah. Well, going from that, I mean, and you sort of referred to the other remakes of Dune, and it's been sort of met with mixed success. You know, the movie and you know, some of the other things. What do you think it is about this particular adaptation that seems to resonate and work?
I think Denis just found a way to distill it to its essence. And it's a really poetic film. And I think, weirdly enough, for as wild as it is, there just feels like there's something really personal about it. And it's hard to explain, but I think it's less about communicating an idea. It's just like his emotional expression of what you see on there that just feels like someone's vision. It really does. And I think that has a lot to do with it. I think Timothy is just astounding in it. The mixture of that with the production design and the sound of the piece is just unlike anything I've heard. So, you know, he just captures the truth of the story, which is this great clash of cultures. It's about human history. And I think you feel that in the way that he approaches it. Feels like you can smell it and taste it. It feels very visceral in that way. You know, it's not just heady. It's not like a head trip, but, you know, it has those elements of it, but it, you know, it's, I think there's just deep, deep feeling in it.
Yeah. Speaking of deep, both of these characters, William and the Duke, they're pretty heavy. They're pretty, pretty serious. I mean, did you do anything to decompress between takes besides playing jokes on Denis? But what did you do to sort of get out of that space and get back into it?
Well, on Dune, because I had Josh Brolin there and Timmy, I mean, between, you know, the four of us, and then you throw Momoa into the mix, it's just a madhouse. I mean, it was just, we really, really laughed way too much. And so we just had the best time. We'd play guitars, you know, and we would just constantly be making bad jokes. And it just was, it really felt like, you know, family in a great way. And then on Card Counter, I kind of made that, there wasn't a ton of time. It was only a 20-day shoot. But definitely when Tiffany Haddish was on set, we would have some good times. But on that one, you know, I think it required me to kind of stay in that zone while we were shooting.
Right. Lastly, this is The Awardist, and the reason that we're having you on is because we love your performances, and Dune especially has been getting a lot of attention in the race. How does it feel to be on this ride for potentially two very different things?
You know, it's great. You know, you want, I'd be lying if I said I didn't want the work I do to have some sort of cultural impact. And the more it's talked about, the more people watch it, the more people think about it. It's a rewarding thing. Because so much thought goes into it from across the board, you know, everybody, and these two things in particular, you know, they were a lot of love and passion and point of view was brought to them. So it means a whole hell of a lot to me to be able to continue the conversation about it.
Well, thank you for having this conversation with us. Thank you for your time. It was great meeting you, Oscar.
Thanks, Clarissa. I appreciate it. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you for stopping by, Oscar. Dune and The Card Counter are available to stream now. And that's it for this episode of The Awardist. If you liked what you heard, subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation with us going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials at EW on Twitter, and Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at ClarissaNYC1 and Josh Rothkopf. We'll see you next week.
This episode of the Awardist podcast is hosted by Clarissa Cruz and Josh Rothkopf, produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio, executive produced by Shayna Crockmall, edited and mixed by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.